Whatever comes, we will fight on, and the media will have to go on until that we can't go on anymore. That will be the death of Hong Kong.
Concern grows about Beijing law for Hong Kong. It's Monday, June 22nd. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson. You'll find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Malaysia is optimistic as it reopens its economy. Social media tempers Trump tweets. Refugees continue to struggle in Myanmar and Indonesia. Staying fashionable while in lockdown. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Senior Hong Kong lawyers expressed alarm Sunday at plans for the city's leader to select judges for national security cases, calling it the most serious challenge to the territory's vaunted judicial independence since the 1997 handover to Chinese rule. The move was among the details of a new national security law for Hong Kong released by the official Xinhua news agency Saturday, legislation that is expected to be passed soon by the Standing Committee of China's Parliament, the National People's Congress. As well as heading a new local national security council supervised by Beijing officials, the city's chief executive, Carrie Lam, will also have the power to appoint judges to hear cases under the law. The law is stoking fears among foreign governments as well as Hong Kong's democracy activists, who were already concerned that Beijing is eroding extensive autonomy promised when Britain handed it back under a one-country, two-systems formula. The city's common law-based legal system is widely seen as the bedrock of that formula, underpinning its status as a global financial hub. Hong Kong entrepreneur Lai Chi-ying, known professionally as Jimmy Lai, is a prominent part of the financial hub as a clothing retailer and founder of Hong Kong's best-selling newspaper, Apple Daily. The 72-year-old Lai is also one of the main contributors to Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement. He recently shared some of his thoughts on the new security law.
I think China is slowly going back to the Mao Zedong's era. You know, control is more draconian, and I think Xi is the most absolute dictator of human history. They have total disrespect for law. And now they impose the national security law superseding the basic law and superseding the Legislative Council. So you know that they don't care about law at all. So if they don't respect law, there's nothing for me to expect what to come. You know, anything they want out of expedience will be the right thing for them to do. So, you know, it's difficult for me to anticipate what's going to happen. Well, whatever comes, we will fight on, and the media will have to go on until that we can't go on anymore. That will be the death of Hong Kong. China is not as strong as, you know, as it looks. It's still a poor, not a rich country, still a poor country. They're just very powerful because they have a lot of people. You know, now, when the world start to scrutinize on every act they do, is slowly being stopped by the West. I think as long as the West is waking up, confront China instead of appeasing it, I think China eventually will have to change.
Jimmy Lai is facing 7 charges from Hong Kong authorities, including organizing and participating in unauthorized assemblies and inciting others to take part in unauthorized assembly. You can read more by following us on Twitter at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, and you can see it on the voanews.com website. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. How did Vietnam become biggest nation without coronavirus deaths? Official says Beijing can screen almost 1 million people daily for coronavirus. China halts some U.S. poultry imports amid virus fears. Excitement over Malaysia's steps toward normalcy met with concerns about the economy. North Korea preparing to send anti-South leaflets denouncing defectors. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson. As Malaysia's economy begins to reopen, analysts say the movement restrictions the country took to limit the spread of the coronavirus could also help it recover from the financial downturn it now faces. As Dave Grunebaum reports, Malaysians are balancing economic uncertainties with an upbeat feeling about getting a step closer to their normal routines.
Rush hour traffic has returned to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia's biggest city. And more people are commuting again on the light rail. It could be something as simple as a haircut or a meal out. Malaysians are getting a chance to do more of the activities they used to take for granted.
I feel great about it, and right now one of the first things that I'm doing here is that after 3 months I'm out for a meal on my with my husband. And I haven't actually gone out in quite a while, so that's great.
The government is being credited for the movement restrictions for several months to contain the spread of COVID-19. But as life gets closer to normal, the country faces the significant toll on the economy. English teacher Jesuina Roy says she and her husband still have incomes, but many of their friends are not as lucky.
We know some people who've completely lost their jobs, who have got no earning power at all, and it's difficult because it's husbands and wife, and they have kids, and then it's rent to pay and mortgages to pay, and there's no money coming in, and you know, it makes me worried. How would you sleep at night? How do they go about from their day-to-day activities, thinking and worrying about where the next paycheck is coming from?
Naveen Pillay just graduated from university with a degree in mechanical engineering. He has applied for about 20 jobs already, but says the competition is especially tight this year.
Yeah, there's more competition compared to, and also we have a fewer job applications being opened to all the fresh graduates.
In the month of April, we recorded 5% unemployment rate. That is the highest in the past 30 years. And we are seeing double-digit drop also in wholesale trade, which perhaps hints at the weak consumption pattern that we could be seeing for the rest of the year.
Researcher Lau Zhang Zhou says government stimulus measures are helping, but the country's dependence on tourism and oil is taking a toll.
The drop of the oil prices matter to the Malaysian economy, especially to the ability of the government to finance its operations, because a third of our fiscal revenue, our tax revenue, comes from petroleum-related sources.
Eric Chia, a construction cost engineer, says his income has dropped significantly since March.
It definitely will change my lifestyle, meaning to say there will be no vacation for this year and next year, I suppose. And there will be less eating out in the fancy restaurants. We used to go, like me and my wife, we used to go to a restaurant like maybe once a couple of months or a couple of 3 months. But now we hardly go to a fancy restaurant.
And these changes in people's patterns have rippling effects across the economy. So while Malaysians get another step closer to resuming their normal lives, their patterns of living often will not be the same. For VOA News, Dave Grunebaum, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Happening now in Asia, the first plane load of international students to return to Australia since COVID-19 border closures is due to touch down in Canberra next month. The planned return of about 350 foreign students would be the first major reopening of Australia's tightly sealed international borders. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's a brand new week. We're glad you're with us on VOA Asia. Most of us are on social media in one form or another. You can find me on Twitter at VOA Stevenson. Twitter, as you may know, has been an important part of President Trump's outreach as he tries to brand himself as a brash, straight-talking politician. But the social media company has recently begun to flag Trump's tweets in instances that Twitter says are misleading. Other online platforms like Facebook and Snap are doing the same with a variety of information sources. We hear more from Tina Trin.
President Trump recently signed an executive order intended to tamp down on what he views as censorship by social media platforms such as Twitter.
The choices that Twitter makes when it chooses to suppress, edit, blacklist, shadow, ban, are editorial decisions, pure and simple. They're editorial decisions. In those moments, Twitter ceases to be a neutral public platform.
His move comes on the heels of Twitter's recent decision to fact-check Trump's tweets and label another as glorifying violence. Marianne Franks of the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative says Trump's executive order threatens the very democratic ideals it claims to protect.
Because there is a real conversation to be had about the role of social media platforms and the role that they play in public discourse, but this was the worst possible way to have that conversation because it's such a naked exercise on the part of the president to try to do exactly what the First Amendment prohibits, which is government interference with the freedom of speech.
The executive order targets Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which shields online platforms from liability for user-generated content, but also allows them to remove content that is offensive, violent, or objectionable.
Social media companies that engage in censoring or any political conduct will not be able to keep their liability shield.
The Center for Democracy and Technology has filed a lawsuit, arguing that the executive order will discourage social media companies from flagging misinformation during a critical election year.
Suddenly, when they're looking at tweets from far-right blogs or from far-left blogs, and they're trying to decide, should we fact-check this? Should we add information that says, user, you may want to get a little bit more information about this? They're going to be deterred from doing so because of the fear of government retaliation.
Facebook has chosen to take more of a hands-off approach.
I don't think that Facebook or internet platforms in general should be arbiters of truth.
The company removed Trump campaign ads featuring a Nazi symbol after pressure from civil rights groups and 1.4 million combined impressions.
Zuckerberg can say that they're not supposed to be arbiters of truth, but what he's really saying is they're going to disavow all their responsibility for getting us to this moment that we're in.
So who's ultimately responsible for policing social media content? A recent poll conducted by Gallup and the Knight Foundation found that Americans aren't settled on the answer.
They don't really trust the social media companies. An earlier poll of ours also found that they trust the government even less to make those rules. So there's a trust gap.
Independent oversight boards may be one solution.
8 in 10 of Americans think that independent bodies that can set content policy for platforms is good, as long as they have some of the qualities that we typically associate with broader democratic institutions, such as transparency, such as independence, such as diversity.
In a space full of online voices, it's one way to make sure everyone is heard. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. Giant footprints found in an abandoned coal mine apparently belong to Australia's biggest predatory dinosaur. Analysis by the University of Queensland estimates this huge meat-eating predator was about 10 meters long. That's almost as big as a Tyrannosaurus rex. You'll find this and more on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, it has been 8 years since Aung San Suu Kyi's by-election win. Her victory raised hopes that refugees who had been displaced by 7 decades of fighting in southeast Myanmar's Karen State would be able to return home. But a majority remain without a permanent residence as sporadic fighting has continued into this year. Steve Sanford talks to refugees and displaced persons from Karen State about the ongoing conflict.
On the Thai border and in southeastern Myanmar, about 250,000 refugees and IDPs remain in camps and temporary settlements. Access to food is a growing concern, along with the added threat of COVID-19, as sporadic fighting continues between Myanmar forces and armed ethnic groups. A camp leader spoke about the ongoing conflict earlier this year and little has changed since then.
Some of the villagers have lost their animals because the Myanmar soldiers kill their pigs, chickens, ducks, and cattle without asking from the owner. Many villagers who went back home face this problem. They cannot accept this, so they run back to the IDP camp.
Despite a fragile ceasefire in Karen State, the cycle of disruption is ongoing, instigated in part by battles over territory linked to a growing number of infrastructure projects. For camp elders like Jaka A, whose nephew was killed in 2018 during a Myanmar army offensive, hopes for a return to peace have faded.
I think the fighting will continue. It's never stopped or ended. I have to run away from conflict all my life. If there's no more conflict, it's going to be better for my life, so I don't need to escape anymore.
Many of the border refugees speak Thai and work outside the camps for extra income. But without work permits, they face employer exploitation or worse, arrest by Thai police. That's why many aid groups see official resettlement in Thailand as a viable and beneficial option for all parties.
For others who aren't prepared to go back to Myanmar yet, the challenge will be more about how do we expedite the legal pathways for them to get access to employment in Thailand, which in itself helps to support remittances back to communities, whether that's in southeastern Myanmar or even in the refugee camps.
Steve Sanford for VOA News in Chiang Mai, Thailand.
Coming up on VOA Asia, we hear about refugees in Indonesia.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia, the COVID-19 pandemic continues to make life even more difficult for thousands of refugees in Indonesia who have no access to formal work or school. Many are awaiting resettlement to another country while relying on relatives in other countries who are also dealing with business shutdowns. VOA's Randy Wixana spoke to several Afghan refugees in an independent refugee community in the province of West Java, Indonesia.
Life had already been challenging for Najibullah Akbari and his family even before the COVID-19 pandemic. Akbari, an Afghan refugee born in Iran, ended up leaving the country of his birth because he did not feel it was safe. For almost 5 years, he and his family have lived in Cisarua in Bogor Regency, a mountainous area situated about 30 miles from Indonesian capital, Jakarta.
It is, I think, all time is like Corona, because refugees are at home and they cannot do any job, they cannot travel, they cannot visit their relatives. This is like the Corona time.
Indonesia is not a signatory of the 1951 UN Refugee Conventions, which makes the estimated 14,000 refugees in Indonesia ineligible for formal work and education. To survive, most refugees rely on relatives in other countries to wire money to them. Akbar Anwari says his brother in New Zealand has stopped sending money since the pandemic also affected his job.
My brother has been out of work for 5 months. Nowadays, he no longer sends money. I spend about $245 a month. Rent, food, I eat very modestly. But prices this season are very high.
Akbar Anwari speaks fluent Indonesian, known locally as Bahasa Indonesia. He now uses those language skills to teach Indonesian to other refugees in a community-based school called RLC, or Refugee Learning Center. Like most schools, social distancing has meant RLC had to convert to online classes. Unfortunately, this poses a challenge to students and teachers since many don't have sufficient internet access or proper devices. Many in Indonesia access 4G networks via expensive prepaid data plans.
So they face many challenges like lack of resources. Most of our teachers use their cell phones. Some of students are not joining the call because they don't have data.
The learning centers relies mostly on donations for the education program and for masks and sanitizers that have become scarce due to pandemic. The Indonesian office of the UN Agency for Refugees says they lack the funds to assist these refugees and say more than 3,000 independent refugees are living in the country during the COVID-19 pandemic. Only about 500 out of the 14,000 refugees in Indonesia have been resettled by UNHCR to countries like Canada and the USA. From Bogor, West Java, Indonesia, Randy Wicaksana, VOA News.
As women around the world adapt to working remotely, many are finding it both liberating and challenging to dress from the confines of their homes. So how are working American women staying stylish during online meetings and presentations, and what are they wearing when they're not appearing on camera? VOA's Julie Tabo spoke with experts in the fashion industry about current sales trends and a gallery director who shares how she enhances her online appearance with simple fashion accessories.
So today I thought I would introduce you to four scarves that I have in the color green.
Textile designer Martina Sestakova has noticed a spike in sales of her colorful scarves since the outbreak of the coronavirus.
Recently, one of my clients purchased a scarf, and the customer said, I really, really need this in my life right now. I am an art teacher. I cannot be with the children in the classroom. They are now watching me on the screen. How do I make myself feel good? And how do I kind of, you know, draw attention to myself? So she picked this bright pink scarf. And then the following day, she said, I got so many compliments and I have felt good. So it's working.
That's also working for her client, Mary Higgins.
Every Zoom meeting that I have, I'll put on earrings, I'll put on a scarf and a necklace. And it just is something that makes me feel more professional.
Rank and Style is a website that features top 10 lists of the 10 best products in the fashion, beauty, and lifestyle categories. There's been a noticeable surge in sales of comfort clothes, says Chief Product and Marketing Officer Beth Zerdecki.
Surprisingly, the biggest trend has actually been in bottoms, which you wouldn't think with so many people being focused on Zoom meetings. But I think people are needing something that's comfortable enough to work from home in, but also something that feels a little bit elevated.
Specifically, joggers, leggings, and denim shorts.
That's been a very surprising one. Major, major increase, over 200% over last year.
The Notori Company is a high-end women's fashion brand, mostly known for luxury sleepwear and undergarments. Their online sales have been robust, says its president, Ken Notori.
But we've certainly seen with COVID, you know, a lot more of an appreciation for, you know, loungewear and sleepwear that makes women feel special. And so, you know, our online business has benefited accordingly.
While some states are slowly reopening after months of lockdown due to the pandemic, Beth Zerdecki says that shift has not yet been reflected in consumer behavior.
They're not looking for that super trendy top or cocktail dress. So we're still seeing these trends continue into the summer.
Until that time, working women can continue to wear clothes that give them comfort and enhance their look with simple accessories. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia, and of course you can follow us on Twitter as well, also at VOA Asia. We're on Instagram and YouTube, and at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and we also thank our managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team. That's Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Pulpaboon. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a wonderful day. Be safe. Be well.